Hi, I'm Stuart McAllister with Reflections Ministries.
I'm Ken Boa. We're going to have a good talk together as we process some very critical issues in our time that often are overlooked or not properly construed.
Ken, as you know, we've talked about being older navigators or explorers on the journey of faith. And I was looking at this passage here, and I just thought, because this is priming some thoughts for us to discuss, but you know, So Paul, the veteran, writes to Timothy, the young pastor, in 2 Timothy chapter 1, 6 or 8. He says, "For this reason I remind you to fan into flame the gift of God which is in you through the laying on of my hands. For the Spirit God gave us does not make us timid, but gives us power, love, and self-discipline. So do not be ashamed of the testimony of our Lord or of me, his prisoner. Rather, join with me in suffering for the gospel by the power of God." Of course, he goes on to talk about being called to a holy life. One of the things I really wanted to just discuss with you is over time, obviously, in history, every season in life is challenging, but our moment particularly, the issue of shame and the role of fear has been so palpable that I find many people are struggling with either any desire to articulate the gospel and certainly a lack of courage in being willing to share it because they're uncertain about how do I live this faith and even stand for things in light of all the challenges to the faith. What are your thoughts about that with shame and fear?
Yes, shame and fear, and then also sometimes guilt and shame. All these are weapons that seem to be used for people who are increasingly uncertain as to where they stand in this world, because there's a growing, I fear, uncertainty and insecurity because we're not clear what we're supposed to believe anymore and who we should follow. And so the temptations to be relevant can actually diminish our capacity for being obedient.
So let me pull you in on that one, because you know, we've both been involved all of our life in public ministry, our desire to share with people. And, you know, the desire has always been very strongly to engage meaningfully with truth, you know, looking at movies, film, songs, and be relevant. And yet it seems that something has changed in terms of this desire, where the desire for relevance itself has become a part of the problem we now face. Because when you make relevance rather than faithfulness or clarity, perhaps you soften down the central demands of the gospel, the clarity of what the lordship of Christ means, holiness, maybe some of the rough, the sharp edges of the gospel, yes. And the unwittingly we drift over time.
It's actually an interesting thought experiment to imagine in the first century Paul's attempt to be relevant to his culture. How would that have worked for the gospel in Thessalonica or in Corinth or in Rome? And so really just what's obvious looking back into the New Testament, we see that they were clearly contra mundum, against the world, and that the gospel had a bigger vision, a richer vision than just the kind of idolatries that people have succumbed to and been subverted by. And so the very nature of that, the idea of being relevant to those processes would seem an absurdity, but yet in our time, it seems that we want to make it so.
So there's obviously a history. There's a history in events. There's a history in ideas. But that's a very telling thing, because sometimes I think we read the Bible, we read church history through a romanticized lens. Yes. And so we try and insert ourselves back into a context that was very different, and yet we're blinded to our own moment. So for instance, like you were saying, relevance was not a criteria. Their challenge was they had experienced the conversion in Christ. They knew the lordship. They knew that to say Jesus is Lord was to go against Caesar or to go against the Jewish authorities, and if they were coming out from Judaism, saying that Jesus was the Messiah. And yet the church did not have power, did not seek relevance, and had to grow through suffering, faithfulness, wrestling with Scripture, and battling for her life. And yet, by the grace of God, the church obviously came through that and has carried on to the ages. Fast forward to modern times, where we have been raised in a generation where we're going through the modern era and the change in modern culture, but we've kept feeling that, oh, the church is outdated, the church is irrelevant, we've got too many uses of crosses or the Old Testament, and we keep capitulating, softening the message, adjusting the demands, watering down the truth, weakening the thought, adapting to the demands, social dynamics of pressure. And yet, at what cost? I mean, what does faithfulness look like in our moment?
And the price for faithfulness has always been great. And Jesus made it clear from the very beginning, the inception, if the world hates you know that it hated me before it hated you, as he said in John 15. And this is, as you know, in the Upper Room Discourse, if you were of the world would love its own. But because you're not of the world, but I chose you out of the world, because of this, the world hates you. Remember the word that I said to you, a slave is not greater than his master. If they persecuted me, they will also persecute you. If they kept my word, they will keep yours also. But the point that he's telling them is from the very inception to realize you're going to pay a price. Discipleship will cost. And unless you have a bigger vision than this world's vision, you will not be willing to pay that cost. And I think that thinness of vision has been intentionality, aspiration, and being animated by a greater desire than just living well in this world and having comfortable time on this earth.
Yeah, that's the part. So, I mean, I think, you know, we all try and diagnose this, I mean, for our own life, for how we walk with God, but equally with people that we see around us, we think, why is it? I can think significantly, I'm aware of what's going on in the Carolinas with many of the Methodist churches fighting over, of course, the wondering how to handle the sexual ethics thing and the change in church preaching. And I can think of someone who I know very, very well from a church in our region here, a person who was a very committed, serious Bible preacher for years. And yet last year, I was talking to other people about this same pastor now, who has basically, like many others have done, has clearly softened on this image and believes now that there's an openness to embrace many of the new social realities and that Christians have been unfair and unjust. In some cases they have, we know that. But the question that is left unanswered is again, who gets to determine what the scripture actually says and means? So we're back once again to the authority of the Bible, the plain meaning of the text as it's seen. Aha, but you don't have the Greek, or you don't understand the anthropology of the time, or you haven't done a sufficient background. So you're labeled as a fundamentalist or whatever. But very practically, people have to make decisions day by day on what they believe God is saying, what they believe his word means, what are the requires, what is the moral consequences and entailments of believing these things. And I can see how shame and fear, just as with, here's Paul speaking to Timothy, encouraging him in his context, but in ours, because of social media, because of our cultural moment, it's far more pervasive and it's much more invasive. So the intimidation factor is incredible, and it seems to me it's neutralizing a lot of preaching. It's mutualizing, emasculating or just flattening out a lot of teaching, preaching.
They're afraid to go against the current of the culture because more and more people would rather be wrong with the rest of them than to be right and then to be vilified for that and to stand firm on a particular view. So we find a way of adapting that. And there are so many forces that would cause us to desire to be well thought of and to be, we don't want to have discomfort. We don't want to be vilified by our friends and our neighbors. And so in my view, the cost of discipleship has been pretty well ignored. And it's radical message. And this is, I think, a huge component. Revisiting the radical dynamic of a worldview that we embrace. If this is true, then it means that we are in a short world to prepare us for our eternal citizenship in heaven, and that there is warfare going on, this internal warfare with the flesh, and then the external warfare with the world and with the devil and his angels, and that's to be taken seriously. And we're told that our warfare is not against flesh and blood, but against angels and principalities. So these are bigger things than men, but yet they are inspiring a culture to embrace collectively and increasingly a vision that is inferior to the vision that they should be having, the vision that's subpar, sub-Christian, But they are terrified of standing against that because they don't have enough that they're standing for.
So we have been, in very many respects, fair weather Christians in this country. So, I mean, Americans have assumed a level of Christendom that, you know, Christian culture, Christian heritage, and even some of the ways that people's energy has been redirected towards fighting for causes more for conservatism and the protection of privileges or positions or power, but rather than standing for the clarity in what the gospel means. What does it mean that Jesus is Lord? How do we keep the centrality of the kingdom and service and loving and preaching with all the costs and consequences that that brings, yes, irrespective of the moment? But we've definitely had the agenda blurred, and it's made it kind of hard or difficult to sometimes be clear. Well, what does it really mean to be faithful in this moment, at this junction? How should I then live, in Francis Schaeffer's words from many years ago?
Yeah, and how should we now live? Yes, how should we then live? How should we now live? And this vision of understanding our time, understanding what we need to do, but also contextualizing ourselves as really agents of light in a world of darkness, and to recognize that we will not be, the message will not be well received by the majority of people. But if our identity is based upon people's expectations and opinions, then we want to be mollifying everybody and everyone's happy. But then we have a thinness in our own message. There's not enough that sustains us into a life of fidelity, of obedience, and indeed being rejected because of the gospel.
Let me push you in this, Ken, because that's what I wanted to try and go into a little bit, is on, okay, but the difference between courage, morally grounded, biblically centered, and belligerence.
Yes.
So the person who's basically angry, and, you know, angry at the Dems or angry at the conservatives or whatever, and is out there, you know, and it just spreading on the internet, firing hate mails left, right, and center, and, you know, and retorts. What's the difference? How do we have moral courage and spiritually anchored versus agitation and belligerence?
Yes, and that's a very important distinction. And you and I have been talking a lot about the whole idea of not wringing our hands and in despair and cursing the darkness, but rather being people who actually promote what we love and the things that are of truth, beautiful and good and true. But at the same time, we also know that there's going to be a cost to be made and paid, because if we begin to play games with certain issues that the scriptures affirm, and we want to begin to back off from that so that we don't appear to be wrong, I think that's the danger when we begin to pay a seductive price that removes our integrity. And so disciplines, I think we've talked a lot about this idea of training in righteousness, that we train ourselves to see the world as it really is, as God sees it, as from an eternal perspective. And the more I embrace that, the more then I see that is against the world, that the things we're pursuing are contrary to its agenda. But that's always been so, and I have to have the historical perspective. But it is helpful also to exegete our culture and to understand the times, because I can say, and I think you would agree, that our cultural diminishment at present is unprecedented, and there are new factors that are involved.
I threw that phrase in, I was sort of toxic sociality. Yes. Because it really does. I mean, in one sense, you know, like we're two grumpy old bears, old guys, you know, basically you're out of touch with reality. And yet, I mean, I talk to a lot of younger people, my son and some of his friends, and, you know, they are saying it in a different way, but they're very much seeing and feeling and concerned about these things. I think the rise of the social media, the explosion of AI and internet controls in our life and guidance, and then the adaptation of life as we keep trying to modernize, upgrade, stay in. But with all of the causes that are thrown into there, you find this explosion of information and the amplification of data, but also anger, so much anger and so much anxiety. So it is hard. It's hard to find stability, focus, and clarity. And when it comes to being a serious Christian living by the confession that Jesus is Lord, He is my King, He is my Savior, and yet I'm in a place where anything about that can be a spark to a flame.
That's
in my job with my kids, if I do a text to the wrong person or if I phrase something the wrong way. So we find this sort of zone of anxiety mm-hmm. constantly surrounding us and maybe choosing silence and yes. invisibility yes. as the options.
And that is a dangerous option because then we become silent in the gospel. Then we become unfaithful people who then say, let someone else do it. Here's him. Let's send him, not me. I have a list of seven things in this perfect storm that would be interesting for us. I'd like to get your opinion about each one of these and how they relate to this topic. The first one, because there's a diminished collective capacity that's becoming increasingly evident. And this, the past 70 plus years has been a perfect storm. But what's been interesting is that really since 2000, the idea of Christianity in this culture, for the previous 50 years, has been about 72% or so of the culture of people would be actually going to church or at least affirm a Christian belief, which has gone down now radically since that time in the last 20 years to about 40-something percent. And it was, I think, as a result of certain new phenomena that never existed before that need to be added to the mix. And the first one of those is this idea of critical thought or identity politics or postmodernity in general. And how would you summarize that as a factor that would be in play in the discussion we've just been having?
Well, I think a big part is that the question of received knowledge and truth has been shattered because basically generational transfer of beliefs, ideas that were bought into, maybe a person could assume for sometimes, well, my dad did this, I believe this in my grandfather. They may have gone to the same church for decades, or they may have been associated with a group of churches, and there was a kind of a family heritage. But today, I think there has been a complete break in those belief structures and support structures and the ideas themselves, so that radical individualism, each person defines their own worldview and therefore lives within it, whether it is any tie to the past or not, yeah. is no longer an issue. So I think you've had a social fragmentation that continues and is expanding as time
yes.
goes on.
So this whole idea of we cannot know and that the Enlightenment project was a failure and as a consequence we became arrogant, but now we can't really know anything. So it just, we move away from reason and from evidence, let alone common sense, as measurements of truth. Instead, when we get away from empiricism and rationalism, what do you have left?
Well, I think it's astonishing that when you're talking to people now that they don't realize that basically everybody walks by faith. You know, the question is what they have faith in, but they've shifted their, they can't say, they like to invoke science, or I'm just a reasonable and scientific person, but actually they're putting faith in some authority because they cannot prove or justify or stand on. And there's no cultural consensus, there's tribalism. So their view happens to be my faith option. And they talk about us as Christians as if we have, you know, blindly adopted faith. But the question is, does faith have an object that is trustworthy? And that, as for us, that would be God and the gospel and the scriptures. And we would say, yes, there is strong reasons to believe.
Yes, when it comes to faith, then, those two fundamental truths, number one, everyone lives by it. No one can avoid it. Number two, it's only as good as the object in which it's placed. And those are also universal principles. So everyone walks by faith. The question is the substance of the object. Yeah. So the second of these trends is this mediaization, as I call it, into cultural imbecility.
Yeah. Oh, I think that's a huge one. I think the explosion, we all loved the revolution. I remember when first we started getting, you know, VHS and beta and the tapes and so forth, because you could bring film home. But within 5 or 10 years, we had gone the explosion where you not only could bring it home, you could have it on your hand mm-hmm. and all these various new technologies. So now where it's totally ubiquitous, where you carry it with you, where everywhere you go, everyone's got a phone, they're in a car, they're watching it, they're walking down the street, they're falling down potholes because they can't
falling
see
down,
it.
Yes.
So I think consciousness in the many years ago in the Star Trek, the New Generation series that yeah. we were introduced to the characters called the Borg. And the Borg are these species that absolutely absorb their biological and technological and cultural distinctives of every other alien into this Borg collective. One, all is one, kind of one is all. And I think that's what's happened with media. It's this entertainment, information, tsunami
yes.
that basically drowns the soul and colonizes the mind.
Yes, a good way to put it, yes.
And I think that's what we find with people saturated by trash, soul trash, that drowns us and prevents us having discernment or just appeals constantly to, it's like eating Dunkin' Donuts every day of your life. You know, who wants salad? I'll have another donut. Yeah. But a donut of the mind yeah. and a donut of the soul.
You could see it, a mental virus.
Yeah.
As it were.
An infection.
Yes, an infection. A third one that I see, and it's fascinating with these various seven, I have a list of seven, but there are many. But in this perfect storm, they're not dependent upon each other, but they reinforce each other, and they're coincident in their appearance, and all really within the last few years. It's amazing, especially since 2007 with the smartphone and all these technologies merged. The third one I have is AI, and then the whole idea of immersion in dark, doubtful digital spaces, and what's the nature of the metaverse, and that's a powerful and growing idea of being pulled away from the analog world into the digital realm.
Well, and I think you see that. I mean, I have not played video games in my life just because it was not a thing I was terribly exposed to, but I'm very, very aware of people who are totally devoted to it. And I have, we've all talked to adults and friends who have got 35 and 40-year-old kids at home, literally, who have never left because they're playing, you know, World of Warcraft or whatever it is in these online games, and they get absorbed into this virtual world that they can't engage with real life. So the technology is wonderfully, I think you and I talked about this. Remember, I said to me, I think the dominant idols of our time are mammon and magic.
Mammon and magic, that's right.
And mammon being the constant idea of more money, more pleasure. Magic being the technological toys that seduce us. And I think this is one of the AI that we're wowed. When look at, I can go into the galaxies. I can put on this virtual technology. I can be in combat with someone and all the bloodlust and the. But again, who and what am I? Am I a man and woman, or woman made in the image of God, by God and for God, or am I just a consumptive creature who lives by nothing but appetite?
And in that context, then they're not connected to anything in the analog world, but rather this digital space, which becomes more treasured by them and more valued by them than actually achieving something in this real world, because that world of that artifact becomes so compelling.
It strikes me, though, I was thinking about a few weeks ago with Jerry Root, we were looking at Screwtape Letters with the C.S. Lewis Institute, and it strikes me that this is a perfect Screwtape scenario, isn't it? I mean, here you can just imagine the demons and all that working when, let's just give them more toys, more pleasure, more fun, and keep them distracted so they'll never think about reality, they'll never think about life, they'll never ask the real questions, but their appetites will be satiated with pleasure, more pleasure, more, more, more.
Although
thirsting.
The interesting thing is it takes more and more to get less and less, which is the diminishment of the addictive mindset. But this is what the enemy wants for us to be. And that the fourth one I have is the vapidity of social media, that it's yet another force in addition to the others we talked about. The whole idea of all the spaces in which people now connect together and those realms. And again, that realm becomes one in which you pose, preen, position, posture. Well, often a false self as a result.
Exactly. I mean, you look at TikTok and many of the basically social media things where you see people posting endlessly pictures and sound bites as if all their day is being performed and is of great interest. I mean, how they look, you know, standing beside this bridge, or I'm here on holiday. You know, some of those things we do for friends, but it's become performing our lives rather than living our lives. And I think we don't realize that how much the technology itself defines how we then live. So that instead of it becoming a servant of something we use, we have put our lives in the service of the technology and the upgrades and the new things all the time. So that rather than choosing our life, forming a life, living an intentional life, we're basically living a consumptive life designed by someone in Hollywood or Madison Square Garden or somewhere else.
Yes.
An internet genius who markets to us
yes.
and constantly just pulls us along like a Pied Piper.
Plus, you're playing to people that are, quote, friends, but they have no relationship with you, or you are eschewing actual analog relationships more and more concerned about those kinds of territories in which I have engagement, whether it's in the metaverse where I have these things or whether it's in the social media where a person can be actually based their whole identity on the likes that they get and just be destroyed by those who then begin to actually come after
them. But then you see people whining on public media about the loss of relationships and loss of community, but you can't have both. This is the point. I think that we keep substituting the real for the virtual. And then because when we want the real, we can't get it because everybody else is doing the virtual.
So, which leads me to my fifth one that I have after the social media, what we've called a collective autism, an apathy, and amnesia and anger, by which I mean that collectively, when I say autism, I'm thinking using that as a metaphorical, not the actual thing, but at the same time, one of the things that's associated with that is a diminished capacity for relationships, for other centeredness, for hearing another person, for being involved. And as a consequence as well, when you combine that with apathy, where there's the so what, and then the amnesia, where they don't really know history anymore, and also a victimization with the anger, that's a powerful collective ethos.
I wonder, you know, Ken, you go back to books like 1984, A Brave New World, and we saw, I mean, these were imaginative constructs, but the idea that to get people, when we get kind of socialized or formed into this kind of apathetic malleability, or where we're just plastic, we can grow anyway with the wind. Yeah. And what is lost is the human and the individual, and therefore the very dignity of what it means to be made in the image of God as an acting agent. We lose something very precious about humanity, about community, about love, truth, goodness, and beauty as it's embodied and lived out because we've substituted or we've allowed ourselves to be drugged and put to sleep or poisoned by our own toys. I mean, it's the Garden of Eden being played out all over again in our lives, isn't it?
Yes, it's like that soma that's being used in that whole idea of causing people to give them some basic entertainment, a feeling of well-being and so forth, and let them live in those worlds of delusion whereby we can actually control their thought and their process and their beliefs and give them the wonderful delusion that this is all inspired by their own imagination, their own minds, when actually what they're pursuing is not what they would themselves have selected, but what others have selected for them. Mm-hmm. There's a sixth one, and this we're old enough to remember and physically see the change in film, television, popular media, books, magazines, and advertising. It's fascinating. Take any one of those. And if you just did a decade by decade observation, choose, let's say, TV, and then take any genre you want. Let's take a family show. What does the father look like in the 50s? And then in the 60s and the 70s? And any one of those things becomes a cultural narrative that shows its steady declension.
Yes, because I think that what we forget is not just with the technology, but the beliefs that had been taking shape in our culture that had been shaping and driving. So the messaging within these was very significant. And this fundamental reaction against Western culture, against Christianity in particular, Judaism, or the Judeo-Christian, if you want to put it that way, classical view, and the idea of leveling the playing field and scrubbing history of all these things and bringing us back to this tabula rasa, this open idea that we can now recreate society. So we have to make sure fathers, authority, family structures, all of that was bad. All structure, all inherited creation was a problem to be solved rather than something to be modeled. So whatever the television would be about, programs on the family, on the individual, it's all about dysfunctionality in the search for new romantic versions of freedom.
Yes, and this romantic version of freedom involves then a diminishment into a collective consciousness, a kind of a mindset that what's fascinating, though, is that people are more moralistic in some respects, even though they are, at the other side of the coin, absolutely unconnected, disconnected with any actual virtue, because there's not a moral consensus as such that's based upon any true virtue.
Now they're fundamentalist relativists.
Now they've become fundamentalist relativists and judgmental of anyone who doesn't embrace their view. That's why, as you well know, tolerance has been redefined from agreeing to believing that I can love a person, even if I don't agree with their belief and behavior, to now you got to believe in mine or you're not tolerant.
It's like the phrase I hear people say, that as one guy particularly says, he always says, It's all good. It's all good.
It's all good.
But actually, it's not all good. And that's the point. It's not all good.
Imagine that in the words of St. Paul. It's all good.
It's all good.
Yeah, just put it into any Bible character and you'd know there's something, there's a disconnect here. We go back to a thinner and thinner culture that's based upon a kind of a world that is more compelling because we have greater collective wealth than ever before, but less wisdom, greater sense of power, but less actual virtue to sustain that power.
It sounds like, Ken, also we're describing a sense of ongoing splintering and fragmentation, but we're also in the process of something that we cannot name yet, describe yet, but we feel that there's something pulling us towards some kind of enforced conformity.
Now you have my seventh one, because that's the seventh category, globalism as a mandate. So all these seven when this perfect storm, so that on the one hand, there is this idea that I'm my own authority, but on the other hand, actually, it's a diminished authority because you're actually following the narrative of others and they can track everything you're thinking and saying and your preferences and all of those components as well.
Well, I think in the strategic plans of the Chinese Communist Party, and they're not alone, is that information dominance is the number one priority. And you see that in the West as well, trying to get information in our societies. So here again, it brings us full circle back to that there's an inherent monistic drive in belief systems to insist on one way only to do the truth, and conformity is the demand. And now we have political, social, and moral, and economic pressures that are going to enforce that. So we are back again to, if we live from a word but from beyond, and we are in a world in which that Babylonian captivity is increasing, and, you know, what does it mean to be a faithful Christian, to stand up and say, I believe in Jesus. I believe in the gospel of Jesus Christ. I believe in that he is the way, the truth, and the life. No man comes to the Father but by me. And he calls us to follow him and to be holy.
Which will probably be our next talk, which will have to do with the cost of discipleship and understanding that we are really now pursuing a different vision, a richer vision, but there will be a price to be paid for that vision in so many levels.
Well, I am looking forward to talking about that with you.
Very good. God bless you.
And you too.